It's not conservative. It's progressive. The truth that empowers. Right here on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network. Peter R. Breggin, MD, is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, folks. Hello to the best audience in the world, the most enlightened psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, clinical psychologists, counselors, and, of course, advocates, victims of psychiatric injury, and just all sorts of people all over the world. Delighted to be with you again. Check out Mad in America, Bob Whitaker's website. I have a new blog up there that's got 2,500 people looking at it the first day or two on the school shootings and on the difference between school shooters and religiously and ideologically motivated shooters. And then I provide new information on some shooters that where information hasn't been out before. The Aurora Theater shooter who killed so many folks and was sentenced to prison for the rest of his life a year ago. Holmes, I talk about information about him and psychiatric drugs that's never been out before. And I also will take a look at Eric Harris's record in a way that's not been public before, and talk about the relationship between his antidepressants and his violence, and a couple of other cases that have not really been detailed this much in the past. So new information, new ideas about how to distinguish among the shooters, all on Madness in America, and also a really good new blog by the head himself of Mad in America, and Bob Whitaker, on antipsychotic drugs. It's really a monograph that he's put up, and I hope that people will review that as well. And praise to Mad in America. My guest today, I hope he has connected. Michael, are you there?
I sure am.
Oh, yay. I was talking with Michael on the phone a few minutes before the show. We got disconnected. My old friend Michael and I thought, well, if he can't connect with me, how's he going to connect at all? But he's there. I think this is like your fourth time on the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Third or fourth. Third or fourth. I've lost count.
I've lost count, too. One of my most frequent guests. And as I said to him today, you know, he's just an entertaining guy. I don't know about the content, but actually he's a brilliant psychologist and researcher. And if you ever want somebody really, really enlightening and entertaining to come to one of your conferences and talk about ADHD, he's also a genius with the technology and with cartoons and stuff like that. And he really does a wonderful and entertaining job. Michael has an EDD, he's an educational psychologist, and he's a professor of human development and research methods at The Ohio State University. And that's a recent development for him to be at Ohio State, and maybe you can tell us about that, but I think that's really great. He's been doing research with kids for a long time. He's gotten money, something I've never done, from the federal government. Almost $20 million in research from the U.S. Department of Education, National Science Foundation, and, God forbid, the Department of Justice. Michael, maybe I should investigate you for that. I don't know. You got to tell us why you got funds from the Department of Justice. He's the author of Debunking ADHD, 10 Reasons to Stop Drugging Kids for Acting Like Kids. And he's got a website where he's looking at really trying to look at, you know, really evaluating what are outcomes. And I'm going to let him tell you about that, about his outcomes research, because it's about time somebody paid more attention to outcomes in the work we do with juveniles, children, in the courts, in therapy, and everywhere else. So this is Michael Corrigan, my friend and man of extraordinary talents. Hi, how are you today?
I am great. How are you?
I am getting over a cold that struck me last night, so I'm a little hoarser than usual, but I'm good. I'm working on a new book. I think it's going to be a really remarkable new book, and I'm doing well. Thank you. So the show is yours, Michael Corrigan. Take off. But tell me first about the Ohio State.
Well, like you knew, I was at Marshall University before. I've been at a couple universities, but I'd been there about 10 years. But I'm from Columbus, Ohio, and grew up right near Ohio State when I was little, and just was always looked forward to getting back here, being near family and friends. And I finally applied for a job and got an interview and got the position, and I start teaching next month. And I'll actually be switching from my child development focus to only teaching graduate level research methods, intro to statistics for doctorate level folks, and regression analysis. So it's going to be more on research that I'll be teaching to education students, psychology students, and about seven different other programs. So really excited to be at a major research one university, finally. And
yeah, it's really, I'm very proud to see you get there. I mean, it's maybe a tribute to changing times that a critic like you of the conventional thinking gets a position at the Ohio State University. Do you think that's a good indicator?
I think it's a great indicator of Ohio State being very open-minded. Now, I might not have ever gotten hired in their psychiatry department because I differ greatly from their perspective, but they have some wonderful people in that department who would agree with our views, many of them. So I just think Ohio State is, you know, an amazing university. It hires, you know, tons of excellent thinkers from all different perspectives, and they don't try to push an agenda across the whole board. I think it really helped me because I'm teaching in a quantitative research evaluation program. So I finally get to put my expertise of how to develop assessment tools and all those things to work and help folks understand how to be judges, you know, savvy consumers of what is good research, that you can believe and trust compared to others, and how to design some better studies in the future as they go out in the world. So I am pretty psyched. I will tell you this. It's the first time, four universities now, this will be the first office that I have that I actually have my own thermostat control in the office, and it works.
So, and does it include air conditioning?
Yes. Yeah.
Whoa.
And I have a window, and I'm not in the basement. It's amazing. So.
Oh, that's great. And you're a professor.
Yeah, I'm actually a senior professor on the faculty there. My title is senior lecturer. So it's a nice position where I don't have to do all the tenure stuff. I can still be active in the program, but it allows me to do a lot of the consulting that I do, as you're aware of.
Yeah, that's all good news. That's all good news.
Yeah, pretty psyched. But as for the Department of Justice funding, that was one of my first grants I received. And back in the day, I developed this idea and wrote a book about it called Neighbor's Day. And it was when I worked with juvenile detention students and taught in the juvie, actually here in Columbus and Franklin County. And they loved my program I had to help kids get more connected to the communities, to strengthen communities to support these kids. So they actually funded through their Burn Grant program My Neighbor's Day initiative. So got to do some really neat research, develop some assessment tools, and go out and get schools and communities focused on, you know, creating closer-knit places that can support kids. So, you know, I think the DOJ does some good work. I mean, we could go across the board on all federal programs and pick out the ones that shouldn't be funded or implemented. But, you know, I think for the most part, from what I can tell, many of them are trying to fund some progressive aspects as to how we can help folks do things better. And I know the Department of Justice, you know, and different agencies are starting to work together more closely on different things. So, and our latest endeavor that your friend and my friend, Dr. Robert Foltz, and my other colleague, Dr. Doug Grove, we've developed a new assessment tool you mentioned to look at foster care, residential treatment, psychiatric inpatient treatment, juvenile justice. We're looking at kids that are in the system and the at-risk youth sector. And what we've developed is an outcomes monitoring system called the Multidimensional Youth Assessment 360, the MDYA 360. And what we developed were a collection of assessment tools that, you know, folks can start to use to see if the care that's being provided is making, you know, helping the kids progress to a better level. It also helps the agencies determine if the facilities are providing good care or if the foster homes are providing good care. And our systems, it's just grown since we developed it. And now we're working with some states and looking at applying it to be a more of a child placement system. So, you know, the best way to figure out which foster home is going to be best for each child, how to keep siblings together, which residential facility would be better. Are they ready to come out of juvenile detention and move to some other type of, you know, facility beyond just putting them in jail? Because, you know, there's a lot of work right now is to reduce the stay of kids in jail and find alternative programs for them. Groups like Annie, Casey, and SAMHSA, Building Bridges, a bunch of different folks are trying to find different ways to not have so many kids in jail and help them get better and more home-like settings or group home settings. So we're extremely excited on that one. I don't know if your listeners have heard about it or you've heard of them, but Qualtrics is a company, Qualtrics.com, Qualtrics. They're a billion-dollar company out in Utah, and they've got the world's largest insight platform that allows you to collect data, create real-time reports, and everything else. So they've partnered and licensed the system from us, and they're selling and promoting it for us. And what's really neat is that it provides instant access for magistrates, you know, having to make a split decision, split-second decision as to where this child should go. You know, that might be in their court. And, you know, Children's Services trying to figure out where to put the different kids. So anybody, a case manager in a foster home, can pull up the kids' records right away or file unusual incident reports so they can get immediate help. So it's pretty exciting to us. And there's all kinds of new legislation coming through trying to track the care being provided in foster care, like the Family First Prevention Act and different things. So we're really trying to create a not an accountability system, but a system that helps those using federal dollars make sure those dollars are being spent well, but also helping those in these sectors understand what's working, what's not working. So as we try to explain to the folks, not about accountability, but about applicability, how to apply this data to improve what they're doing.
Michael, do you worry at all? I'm sure you do, but I mean, what are your thoughts on privacy when we have these kind of record systems that people can pull up? I mean, I had an amazing experience where I went to a health provider, not a physician, and went to him with a little bit of a back injury, and he was able to pull up my MRI from the medical center of my shoulder on this occasion. Actually, it was a shoulder injury. I thought, how did you do that? You're not even a part of the medical system. He said, oh, I just paid him some money and I can get access to my patient's records. Do you worry when things are so available? Because I do see the huge advantages, but I worry about the availability of these records.
Yeah, no, I don't think it should be wide open to the public. That's one of the reasons we partnered with Qualtrics is they have one of the safest data systems in the world. It's an amazing organization with offices all around the world. But I'm the same way with you. At times I worry about, you know, with insurance, everything you ever go to the doctor for, it's in there and everybody knows it. So if you had skin cancer and melanoma, like I have had surgeries, you know, so when you go to get insurance, they know everything about you. So good thing I'm with a large university that gets good insurance. But to me, I think one of the things we ran into is so many times with these kids that are in the at-risk youth sector in these different systems of care, they're often not new to the systems of care. They've been in residential treatment before. They've been in juvie before. They've been in foster care. And a lot of times these kids get pulled back in and they show up at a residential treatment center and here's these folks having to do emergency treatment and they have no records on these kids whatsoever. So the nice part is if you're the state, you know, if you're a state that's bought our system, you know, and these you're keeping records of all these kids and we've taken your old records and put them into our new system, now when a person's brought in, the administrators, you know, of the system, and there's a limited number of administrators that each state assigns, they're able to type in that child's ID number or name, and then they have passed diagnosis, they have passed, you know, medication, they have passed treatment plans, they have the whole record as to what they've been through, what they've been challenged by. So instead of having to guess and pick a route that might have not have worked before, might have done more harm than good, you know, you know this didn't work. So to some degree, I worry about Big Brother often. I won't tell you what grant I turned down years ago because they wanted to use my data in a different way. And I just didn't want to go that route. But to me, this is all data that should be available for the care providers to know what this child's been through. Because, you know, as well as I do, there's so much trauma involved with these kids that are coming into the systems of care of at-risk youth. And, you know, you don't always pull those out with simple questions when they're coming in for the first day. And it would be good to have that trauma record. So one of our assessments we have is a trauma history. So any of them could pull up and see what type of trauma these kids have been through and what unusual incidences they've encountered and past, you know, diagnoses or prognosis of them. So we're just really trying to inform the system, but at the same time help them track if the child's doing better or if they're getting better care in said foster home or wherever they might be. So, I think it's hard to hide so much data. At the same time, I think if it's not too personal, and if it's used in the right way, I think it could be very helpful to those in the business instead of leaving them to guess, you know.
Are you, was I correct in saying you're also working particularly with Bob Fultz on, who's been on our show, by the way, folks, and I will have on the show again from Chicago. And I think I introduced you to, didn't I?
You did, yeah. Actually, this all started when we spoke at your conference at Michigan State a while back. Ginger said, you have to meet him, and I did, and then we got on the phone about a week after that conference, started talking. And what was interesting is he had been working on something similar to what we've developed for residential treatment centers, because that's been his specialty for many years, is working in those facilities. And I said, that's interesting, because I've been playing around with juvenile detention center and foster care assessments. So we started talking, and I'm like, here, and I shared what we've been doing. He shared what he's been doing. I said, and then I told him we'd also had a partnership with Qualtrics already with our MDA, which assesses K-12 schools through 8 dimensions. I said, I think they might be very interested in this, because they just developed a new state and local government office within their corporate office in Utah. And he's like, that would be great. And because he had already priced, you know, you talk about privacy, when you have to price building that type of website, that type of web tool to protect all these records, it's astronomical for someone to go out and create that. So with Qualtrics being the partner, and with Bob and I teaming up and developing what we wanted, it's turned out amazing. And he's doing a lot of work with the state of Illinois on different task force, and he's on the national board of one of the larger residential treatment centers associations. And he's had some input into the new legislation to make it more helpful for the kids in the system as well as the workers. So super nice guy. I think I emailed you and thank you, but if you didn't get it, I thank you for introducing us.
So it was Ginger who did it, not me. I thought I did it. See, shows you how memory is self-serving.
Yeah.
And you're doing evaluation work. You're trying to figure out if treatments and placements work?
Yeah, yeah. So, and what we're trying to do is get away from the one question forms that so many people are using out there. You know, are you depressed? You know, obviously. Or have you been depressed? Yeah, everybody will say yes. So one of the things I try to teach my students is there's a difference between in reliability and validity when you have one question asking a basic yes or no, or if you use a scale combined of multiple questions related to the research on a certain topic like depression to assess it. And as you know, that the DSM, the biggest downfall of many things of the criterion and the DSM-5 and before, is none of them really have any statistical validity showing that they actually assess what they say they are assessing. So what we've done is we've gone back and created scales to really look at foster home climates, created scales to look at support being provided. We've got four dimensions within our assessment tool, and then under each dimension are different scales. So we're dimension one is looking at facility climate and environment, and the second dimension, we're looking at the youth well-being. We're looking at, in dimension three, behavioral risk factors. And in dimension four, we look at educational and parent support. So under each of those, we have anywhere from, three to five scales. And what it does is really paint a whole picture based upon reliable and validated scales rather than, one person's opinion. So right now you'll have a staff person or a clinician at these locations often be the one that's responsible for going through and filling out the form, the assessment on the kid coming in. So it's one person's opinion based upon what they're seeing in a very short time frame. And with our assessment, what we do is we have it developed for the staff or the clinician. We also have one developed for the youth to fill out. And we also have one for the youth's parents or foster parents or both. So what we're trying to do is provide a triangulated view of all these different variables under all these different dimensions to give a much more clear picture of how the youth's feeling, what the parents feel and have seen, and what the doctor and staff or caseworkers are seeing. And what you're able to do is get a baseline when they come in and then track them throughout there. And then what we discovered was, a lot of the folks loved our assessment tools, but they also have to do intake forms and discharge forms and change of status forms and risk assessments, trauma history assessments, psychosocial assessments. So what we did was develop additional forms that they already use so to help with their daily work and, a lot of things they had to fill out for different cases, clinical rating scales. So we've really tried to take it to a whole nother level on the psychometrics of the assessment tool, because we could tell it was needed greatly when we reviewed and knew what had been used or not used in the past.
Well, it's good to see you actually getting to do this kind of work, getting to apply your intelligence to things that are going to be hopefully very, very useful over the years. Is there more you want to tell us about this? And we shift over to some other subjects?
Yeah, I don't mind shifting. I'm really excited. I was somewhat of a problem child and got in and out of trouble and had some run-ins with child services when I was younger due to a nasty divorce. So I know what a lot of these kids are going through, and it's just pretty neat on my end to be able to give back and really, try to help them discover a better way to show what's going on. And I'm really hoping a lot of states adopt it. We're working with a bunch of different ones right now. We just kicked off in April, so we're real excited to not only get them using the assessment, but like I said, us going out and training and helping them understand the data better and how to put it to work in their places. So I appreciate it and letting me share the information about it.
My goodness, you'd be what a fabulous motivational speaker you would be if you could get to address both the kids and their, their foster parents or their therapists. Did you ever do anything like that?
I haven't had the chance to work with too many in that sector. A lot of my work's been in K-12 schools and university level and different international things like that with academics. So I'm at the point in my career where I know what I want to do and I know how I want to go out over the next decade or so. And to me, I just want to make a major difference. I'm not as into the publisher parish tenure worry these days. I'm more interested in, how can I really go out and help those in the field figure out things. And you know as well as I do. I mean, I teach my classes the same way I do my presentations. I try to simplify things to a point where they're funny, and I try to have fun with everything. So, I would love the opportunity. I can't wait to start going out and working with different groups. I think I got a new article coming out in Foster Focus magazine this month. At least that's what they told me. But I'd love to start working in that industry and helping those because, I worked in a juvie for a while, and anybody who works in the foster care, juvenile detention, residential treatment, it's sometimes a thankless job. And some of the nicest, best people are just busting their butt with limited resources to make ends meet. And I think they deserve all the support they can get.
Maybe you and me could convince Bob Fultz to sponsor a conference, and my group, we could co-sponsor, talking about all these subjects in a new way. Maybe we should see if we can get him to do that.
Oh, I mean, I know we're going to talk about kids today. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, these are some of the most trauma-ridden children there are, and I mean, you've read all the research, you've written about it even. I mean, like some of these foster children are on 10 different medications. They're some of the most medicated kids that we're seeing. So to me, everything, we've been trying to get regular parents to see, we need to help that industry see it. And many of them have known the approaches they've been being forced to do aren't the best, but some still are buying into that, that pharmaceutical approach to drugging when it's really related to the challenges they're experiencing in life or the challenges or trauma they've experienced before they got to this point in life. So I think it'd be a great topic to look at and get some conferences going on. It'd be wonderful.
Yeah. Maybe at Ohio State or maybe at the Chicago, the School of Psychology.
Yeah, you never know.
Maybe combined and really, really talk about children and what they need. What do they really need? Because they're not getting what they need often now in their homes and in their schools. And we're forgetting how much of our attention and love, discipline and hard work they need. We really are forgetting that. And so many mothers are single mothers now and they're doing most of what the kids get and they're under enormous pressure. Things are not going well for our kids. You agree with that? It's just not. They've been getting worse and worse for decades, I think.
Yeah, I think I think we're becoming more aware of it. I don't know. I went through a hellacious childhood at one point in time. So I know a lot of people, probably many of your listeners, experienced some too. And I think it's existed for quite some time. I'm not sure if it's more or that we're more aware of it. Or people are just turning to too easy of options like medicating and different things to deal with basic childhood challenges and parenting challenges, parents dealt with differently back in the past. But, yeah, I think things have changed quite a bit from the 60s and 70s where not all moms were working. So you have a lot of, both parents working in the home. There's not a lot of parent involvement. Can't tell you how sad it makes me too is I had some friends that had some babies recently, younger family, and they've had to go, you know, they had the child for 6 weeks, you know, and they had to go back to work, and that child's now spending a whole day, you know, sitting in a cubicle, basically, you know. And it's just like that from infancy to, you know, teens and onward, I just don't think they're getting the opportunity to really build that attachment, that trust that it's so essential in the earlier developmental periods, which I think that causes hardship for both. And I just don't know how we handle it all. I mean, my wife is a full-time therapist as well, marriage family therapist, and, you know, I've had the summer off again, and I've been with my kids all summer. They go back August 17th. I'm not counting the days. But it's hard being at home, but it's also very rewarding, and you also get to work on some things you wanted to. And I just think so many parents don't ever have that opportunity to really spend that time, that quality time with kids.
You know, you referred back to the 60s, and I grew up in the 40s and 50s. You know, I graduated high school and went off to Harvard in 1954, and hardly any of my listeners are going to be that old, obviously, maybe none of you. But it does give me the opportunity to describe the dramatic change that's taken place, because in a suburban school up until I graduated high school in 54, I mean, we had no experience with drugs except cigarettes, not a lot, and alcohol, not a lot. That was it. I think we had in my class of 150 one youngster who we knew had problems at home who got pregnant. And we had just very little anything of kids, you know, going to mental hospitals, kids on psychiatric drugs we never heard of. I've literally never heard of it. Now, we had stresses at home. I certainly had what I would call an unhappy childhood, but I wasn't exposed to dealing with a lot of sex and a lot of drugs and other things that I know I would have found unmanageable, even though they may have seemed attractive. I would have found terribly unmanageable. It was a huge advantage to live in those simpler times, I believe. I really think it was, in retrospect. A huge advantage, and that begins to come to an end in the 60s. I mean,
yeah,
by the 60s, your parents are smoking dope.
I don't think my mom did, but I think my mom finally went back to work just because the marriage was going south, I think early 70s. I was at home and had a mom around, you know, the majority of time. Which was good, because I have a bunch of brothers and a sister, and, you know, they were a handful, and I was a handful. So, you know, and I think the bigger the school, you know, my graduating class is around 450 kids. So there's a couple thousand kids in that school, and these days the schools are twice the size of that. You know, my daughter's class, I think, has 600, 700 people in her grade in her school. So it's really hard, I think, from an educator's perspective, too, to keep track of that many people and have a personal connection with them as well. So I don't know what's contributing to it all. I think being a kid, still being a kid, I just don't know if we get the quality time, the outside time. I don't think we get the leniency, the forgiveness to develop at your own unique little pace. You know, we're all expected now with standards and so many different things to behave and, you know, perform academically at certain aspects. And I think from the younger perspective, we've kind of forgotten what child development research has shown us, is that not all of us develop at the same pace. Some of us might be late bloomers. Some of us might come out of the gate real fast, but then slow down or hit a wall. So I think life's contributing to that. I think a lot of parents I know are getting aggravated with having their child having to fit into this little box of what we define as normal. You know, and that to me, I I will never allow an educator or someone to put my kids into that. That was one of the things I wrote, debunking ADHD, is because I have a very energetic, wonderful, creative, opinionated son. And the last thing I wanted for, you know, him and all these other kids that we were drugging to get through a day of school was for someone to call him this. You know, I just find him entertaining and funny and wonderful, and someday he's the most brilliant, well-behaved child I ever met, and then other days I'm calling my mother-in-law to see if she's around to drop him off for the day. But, you know, it's parenting is so difficult, and it's an experience. Yesterday, my daughter needed a physical. She's trying out for high school soccer, so she had to get the physical done before tryout. And we walked in, and there was a teenage couple with a baby. And I took that opportunity when we were in the waiting room together. I said, you know, honey, that's the last thing you want to happen. I said, but that happens all the time now, you know. I just know as a parent, the reason I bring that up is a parent, I think we had my first child when I was 35, 36. You know, I don't know if I was ready at that point, but to have to raise children at the age of 16 or at the age of 21, at the age of 24, it's just such a demanding requirement. And we rarely are trained to raise children, or, you know, we barely know how children develop as you know, regular adults. That's why I always used, you know, kid with some folks, they should all take a child development class before they have a baby, just so they know a little bit more of what to expect and how to plan for the days and how to plan for the years and plan for each grade. So I think a lot of it falls on, I don't know if it's worse now or it's just we need to give parents more resources because they really haven't had the opportunity to focus on being a parent.
True, absolutely true, absolutely true. Are you still doing much work with the ADHD and, you know, your really good principles about dismissing that and your criticisms of the drugs?
Yeah, and you know, I'll speak about anything. I mean, I'm shocked that, you know, we have so many kids under three being drugged for bipolar and anxiety and everything else. It's just insane to me what we're doing there. I'll speak anytime anybody calls me, if I can get there and have the time to do it. And I just like talking about kids. It's not always about drugs. To me, it's, well, you see my presentations, it's about knowing how kids are and how silly some of our expectations are currently. You know, I still use, you know, depending on what the request is, I'll use a little bit of what you've seen and I've presented with you, but you know, I often love to ask people, you know, I share the birth story of Buddha, and it's how he walked and lotus flowers blossomed. I'm like, you know, and I ask folks, was any of your children like this when they were born, or did they just cause havoc from that point forward? You know, it's like we not many people have a perfect child, and yet so many people are being required or expected to create a perfect child, you know, to send a perfect child to school. And what I try to do with educators and with parents and different groups is just help them understand. I mean, you know, a five-year-old's been here, you know what, you know, 60 months. What do we expect them to know already and be able to figure everything out in 60 months here on Earth?
With a growing brain, no less, that's pruning back neurons and growing new connections. And oh, my Lord. It's bizarre what we expect.
Yeah, I'm with you. But, yeah, we're doing a thing at NYU in September, our project for the kids thing.
Well, tell folks about it. See if we can get drum up some interest.
Yeah, NYU is sponsoring it, their Department of Applied Psychology, and it's called, what do they call this conference? Rethinking Children's Mental Health, and all kinds of CEUs available and all that stuff, but Robert Whitaker is going to be with us, Claudia Gold, William Pelham, Bob Fultz, me, Kevin Miller, Michael Gilbert, Noel Hunter, and Robert Spicer. So it's pretty interesting to me because, you know, there's folks on the speaking list that believe that ADHD actually exists, and, you know, there's folks on there that believe a number of things, and then there's folks like us that just say, let's just focus on helping the kid develop it. So there's a bunch of different perspectives being presented, which, you know, should provide a lot of great viewpoints and a lot of good chance for discussion. Because I, you know, that's all I'm after. I don't expect people to believe my every word. But the reason I wrote it was to start, you know, my book was to start a discussion and try to support people like you that have written about all these issues for so long. But that's all we really want is a discussion, you know, to help folks think about what options they have, and they don't all have to do this right away. You know, to me, it's you know, just knowing friends that are therapists and the work that I, you know, and family that work with other families, it's just so many times, it's just, why would you expect the child to behave any differently? You know, you're having marital problems, your other son just got thrown in jail, the youngest son's having major issues right now. You know, a lot of the stuff isn't related to a mental health issue, it's related to a life issue. And I think that's what we're, you know, many of us want to do is come to an agreement that we don't always have to diagnose and medicate everybody. There's so many other things to think about.
Do you have a website that people can go to learn about the November program at NYU?
It's on, where is that? I probably should be more prepared with your website questions. It's for the kids, the number four, thekids-nyu.eventzilla.net. So for the kids, all one word together, -nyu.eventzilla.net. So, and then we have a Project for the Kids Facebook page as well. And you can find out more information about it. It's about childhood and family at Michael Gilbert's association, too.
Yeah, that's great. Michael does wonderful work.
Yep, wonderful guy.
So just Google Michael Gilbert and you'll get there, folks.
Yeah, I think there's enough folks out there speaking. I'm amazed. You probably get all the flyers. My wife gets a flyer every day. They all look the same. They're a trifold. If anybody's mental health practitioner and listening, you know, they probably get them as well. But it's like every single, CEU course that they get is on how to medicate and how to diagnose and how to do all this other stuff. And it's just like the interventions that don't require a diagnosis to begin with just aren't even out there being spoke about. So many of us are ignoring, you know, what child development research tells us and what great parenting, practitioners and experts tell us. I just think so much of it's reliant upon, I think, you know, if a kid is having trauma or has certain things, then by all means, go see a good mental health therapist to get some help and someone to listen. But 9 times out of 10, I just think the whole family needs to go see a therapist so the therapist can get to know everybody and know what the child's going through and try to help everybody figure out a better way to get through it together.
Well, when I work with children who are pre-adolescent, I barely see the children. I mean, I tell the parents if they just work with me for a few weeks or maybe even the first session and learn some better ways of approaching their kids that things should start getting better right away, because if a child's pre-adolescent, you're still the most important people in their lives, and if you get it together, they're going to get it together. It gets more complicated when you're dealing with adolescents because they've got drugs and they got peer pressures and they got all kinds of other things going on, but still even there, the family comes first, I think, in any kind of useful therapeutic model is help the family and the kids get better. It's an axiom.
Yeah. I agree. And my wife actually, some of her clients, she does intensive home-based therapy as well. So she'll visit some clients that are in, you know, emergency situations for the most part. She'll be there three times a week to work with the family in their home, which worries me at times. But at the same time, I see a lot of great success stories come from her on that because she's able to really get in and, you know, help the family develop those things that they need a little bit more than to talk about at the office and send them out, you know, and hope for the best.
You think she'd like to talk about that on the radio?
She is an introvert, Peter. She's a great speaker, but yeah, you never know. I think she'd like to. I think there's some excellent work being done by marriage and family therapists out there from a systems perspective. They approach it more from that aspect. And it's kind of hard for them to work with the existing requirements of Medicare, Medicaid, and insurance companies because, you know, it makes them work backwards from what they've been trained to do. You know, they normally start with taking a look at the whole family and the family background and who's this and who's that and what did they have and what did they do and what's going on here. And now they're being forced to, you know, do the intake, diagnose the main client, and, you know, set up the paperwork for billing. So I'm wondering where that's going. I'm hoping that's changing. That's something you could talk to Bob Foltz about. He was sharing some stuff with me a month or two ago about some new study on how insurance companies are finding that when their clients are treated without necessarily being diagnosed but treated for mental health therapy, that they're not treated for as long. However, when they drug the kids or the client, then that client seems to be on the insurance needs for the next, you know, 1 to 4 years. He was telling me he thinks, you know, insurance companies are going to turn around here when they start seeing the economics of what they've, you know, of the model they've adopted and they're forcing. So
that would be amazing. That would be absolutely wonderful and amazing to do that.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit before we finish up. I think we've got about 10 minutes. You and I have been trying to develop some guidelines for what children really, really, really need. And I sent you a copy of it, and you modified it. And on the top of your list is children are a sacred trust. I don't get much feeling of that from people nowadays, that the children, you know, no matter how you look at it, whether you think of them as your flesh and blood or that you've brought onto earth or whether you think of them as, you know, children of God, we got to approach kids as a sacred trust. I'm glad you put it. I think I had it down a little further. I'm glad you put it as number one. Do you think this is a startling revelation for mental health workers and parents today?
I was always, when I started writing on stuff like this a number of years ago, I asked myself, you know, I thought they took an oath to first do no harm. And as I read up on that, it turns out like a lot of even like MD programs, they don't even require that oath anymore.
No.
You know, and to me, it's from a medical or practitioner side, I had the opportunity to be a clinical psychologist. I spent 2 days at the place they wanted us to go, and I went to my advisor that day and said, I just plan on researching with my psychology degree. Do I have to go back? Because it's such a demanding side of psychology of the field for those therapists. I mean, you're going in to help someone, right? And the last thing you want to do is make their life worse and fail them in that attempt. And especially when it's a child, when they're so fragile and still developing, you know, emotions and all these different things, the whole personality, it's like, I just think you have to think about the child first and what can I do to help that? And the principles that, you know, you set and that I'm helping with, I think they're for everybody. If you work with children, if you're parents, if you're caregivers, teachers, or whatever, But I don't think it doesn't exist. I mean, you're talking about school shootings at the, you know, beginning of the show. When these things happen, and I've worked with a number of schools that have gone through stuff with that, like with Rachel's Challenge, one of my old clients, and different things. You know, the teachers, the first thing they do is sacrifice their life to protect those children. You know, we know parents do that constantly. There's just some parents out there that haven't gotten the memo, and there's some therapists out there that have not read your book or any of your books or any research out there. And what the, I'm blown away by how many psychiatrists, they don't even do therapy anymore. All a psychiatrist typically does on in most clinics around the world, or at least the USA, is, you know, they come in, they look at the intake, and here's your medication. They don't even consider it. So, and when you know so many bad things can come from medication, why take the risk before you just let the therapist that's working with them down the hall see if they can make progress for 6 months or a year, you know, without drugs being added to it, drugs that have major, you know, side effects and health repercussions. So I don't know. I don't know if it's the system forcing more clinicians and mental health staff to do it in a way that might not put children at, you know, as their sacred trust. But I still think a lot of parents do. But I also know from childhood, not all parents were like that, you know. So it's something. I don't know if it's then and now. If it was better then and not now, maybe we should have shared this list back then, you know, and it would have helped people as well.
Well, I'm sure that's so. So much of the misery in the health field, mental health field, is going back to the late '60s and early '70s when organized psychiatry literally went to the drug companies, the APA, and said, we want to be a partner with you. And they literally, avowedly, using the word partnership, went into business with the pharmaceutical industry. And now the inevitable has happened. Psychiatrists are pill pushers, and they've gone ahead. And, of course, being the leaders, they've now got everybody who prescribes pushing psychiatric pills. And it really all goes back to psychiatry's not being able to compete with therapists, individual therapists and family therapists, and deciding, well, we can't compete with them. They do a better job and they charge less money and we're not trained and we're failing. We're running out of money. Our organization's collapsing, literally. Let's go into partners with the pharmaceutical industry and convince everybody that everybody needs to be on drugs, even if they're getting all these other therapies.
Right.
And that is the result. And people need to be reminded about that. You know, I think that because I wrote to Toxic Psychiatry and talked about this psychopharmaceutical complex that everybody knows now, but I should probably repeat every show how much of the misery we're looking at goes back to this multi-billion-dollar collaboration that the psychiatry literally was a leader in, not just the drug companies, in turning themselves into, quote, partners with the drug companies. And it's destroying millions of lives all around the world. And some of the saddest, of course, are the children who never get a break. And you said, yeah, earlier in the show, they're under 3 years old, and because Joseph Biederman got paid off a lot of money from Johnson & Johnson and their subsidiary Janssen to promote bipolar disorder so they'd give more Risperdal. I mean, it's that simple.
Yeah.
They paid him off, and he said, let's give her, and he went around the country promoting the concept of bipolar disorder and Risperdal. And literally, one of the most common things I see in my legal work now is tardive dyskinesia from Risperdal. It all goes back to that unholy collaboration that continues between the top in psychiatry and the drug companies.
Well, and I think, you know, so my dad became a much better man as he got over his challenges in life and was a, you know, alcohol and drug counselor for the VA hospitals for 20, 25 years. And I often think about that. I'm like, you know, how many AA programs, like, medicate or get their clients drunk to come to a session to discuss dealing with their problems? You know, it's like the last thing we want. We want them to come sober so we can actually discuss things. So here we have, you know, adult clients, children clients coming, and we, okay, now we're going to provide them with therapy, with counseling. And what we're going to do, though, is make sure that their mind is numb and, you know, not necessarily sober, and try to put them through therapy. And the biggest thing about being a therapist, in my mind, is being able to make that connection with your client. So how do you make that connection when the psychiatrist down the hall is giving them three different medications to take, and their heart's racing one way, their brain's racing another way, and, you know, it's really hard to get down to, you know, figure out who you are and what your soul's saying, what your brain issues are and what your deals are, where you're, if you're being drugged for it. So to me, it's beyond the long-term effects and the health effects. It's destroying, you know, mental health as it has been. You know, it doesn't give mental health therapists a chance to really do the work that they came to become, because most people that sign up to go into these programs, and I've taught many of them for years, they come in with the biggest dream of being that, you know, amazing therapist that can, with words and kindness and love, help, you know, these folks turn around their lives. And suddenly they realize, no, I'm just, you know, the person pushing the drugs, or no, I'm just the person, you know, trying to help this person that's a zombie now because of the drugs they got put on because I had to diagnose them. So to some degree, I think that's where we're running into, where, you know, the list you and I created was about, you know, just let's give them unconditional love. You know, let's make sure we spend more quality time together and have fun. You know, let's sit down and listen to our children.
And teach them discipline, folks. I'm not a wild-eyed utopian. Teach them discipline,
yeah,
and respect.
Structure. I mean, they need structure more than anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Love and structure.
Yeah.
And they're not getting it in the places they're going to, which is just outrageous in what's happening to our kids. And the analogy to Alcoholics Anonymous is so good, because one of the first things they tell you in Alcoholics Anonymous is get off your drugs and don't make any big decisions in the first year. Don't marry anybody. Don't quit your job. Let your brain dry out from the alcohol. And yet alcohol is more easy to recover from most psychiatric drugs and from any cocktail of drugs. So while AA is telling you to get off your drugs and give yourself a year to recover, psychiatry is saying get on your drugs and what? Recover? No chance. There isn't any progress on these multiples psychiatric drugs. And I do think the progress people make when they're taking one psychiatric drug is just despite the drug. I really believe it's despite the drug. Because
most of them are getting therapy too, so it's hard to divide it statistically which one, you know, had the impact.
Yes. Well, it would be impossible on individual cases.
Yeah.
But it's getting clearer and clearer. The drugs make people sicker and sicker over the years. Bob Whitaker's work is now confirmed in great more detail what I've been saying for years about that.
He's awesome.
You know, tracing what Ginger and I have been tracing and writing a little bit about what's happened to children, you know, back literally in the 70s, who were put 8, 9, 10 years old, were put on on Ritalin for mild ADHD, mild hyperactivity. It was before ADHD. Yeah, mild hyperactivity in the schools, not even at home. And now you follow them up, and they're lower on every single measure as 40-year-old adults. They have got atrophy of the brain compared to the other kids' controls from back then. They've got shorter lives, more criminality, more hospitalization. And it's not because just that they got some Ritalin. It's because from the Ritalin was added on the drugs to help with this insomnia that the Ritalin caused, drugs to help with the depression the Ritalin caused. The kids got demoralized, more drugs for that. And it turned a lot of these youngsters back from the 70s into career mental patients who have been robbed of their lives. We've probably only got a minute or two left. Kind of thoughts in celebration also of your being now a professor at The Ohio State University, congratulating you on that, and parting thoughts about life, What do you want to tell folks?
Well, you know, parents ask me for the elevator speech often, and I tell them just, you know, love every moment. You know, love your child like crazy. And when you got to bring the hammer down, bring the hammer down, but bring it down nicely. But the biggest thing that I see in kids is they just, the ones that are having the biggest challenges, the biggest problems, they don't have a dream yet. They don't see or believe that they can become something that they dream about being. And that's what I try to really help folks do. You know, even when I'd worked with troubled kids back in the day, when I worked at the juvie, I would just tell them, let's just start with the end in mind. Where do you want to be in 10, 20 years? You know, what do you want to be doing? Where do you want to be living? What's your goal? What's your career? You know, what's your inspiration? And I think we need to do that, and we need to help them understand that school's going to get them there. Education's going to be a secret to that. So to me, I really want to help kids develop slowly and give parents a chance to work with them and help them reach that.
My guest, Michael Corrigan, my friend, great researcher, great friend. Thanks for being on the show.